welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind, the show devoted to the cultures of consciousness. About a year ago, I went to the AAR, which is the gathering of professionals in the business of teaching people about religion, the religious studies folk, which was a huge, bizarre and bizarrely unbizarre gathering, like 70,000 people hustling between these different talks, and it was a bit overwhelming. And I went through methodically the whole book of all the talks that all the professors were going to go, and I just went page after page, just kind of to see what people were talking about. And there were some interesting panels, stuff on magic, stuff on alternative religion in California, things I was interested in, but there was only one paper that stood out and screamed, you must see this. And though it has a rather, well, technical title, I'm going to give it to you. It was called Scientific Embodiment, Affective Dimensions of Knowledge in Peircean Abduction, Neurocognitive Science, and the Trika Shaivism of Kashmir. And I was like, whoa. This guy is making connections between the philosophy of Charles Peirce, an American, don't need to go into that now, neuroscience, and hardcore tantric Shaivism. And I was like, okay, this one I got to go to. So I went. It was this wonderful talk by a guy named Chip Horner, who's our guest today. And we started chatting. Turns out we had mutual friends, mutual interests, friends in common, stuff that we had overlapped with. And he sent me his master's thesis called The University of the Forest, which was about ayahuasca shamanism and how to think about some of the pressing topics and issues it raises, particularly the question of how to think about the entities, the beings that seem to be encountered, that are reported to be encountered, certainly in traditional Amerindian shamanism, which is something, of course, that we talk about rather frequently here on Expanding Mind, and how to think about these things maybe in a different way, because from a strict Western perspective, of course, anything that has this character of hallucination or sort of visionary experience is something that happens inside the skull, ultimately inside the brain. It's our own projections. You know, and you all know this story. This is the kind of common story of our Western vision of reality. And then on the other side, you have these traditional accounts, which of course vary tremendously because different cultures and societies tell different stories about their religious experiences and the nature of the cosmos and the nature of the kinds of beings that exist in it. But, you know, in general, there's certain overall ways that people come to talk about the reality of these entities. And of course, increasingly today, we have people in the West who don't grow up in these traditional cultures, who have experiences with psychoactives or with other vision-inducing practices, often in a traditional or neo-traditional kind of context, and they come up with their own explanations and experiences that challenge the typical way we think about these things as just being in our heads. And it's actually a really, really important question, not so much just because of the attempt to understand what's happening in shamanic experience, either, you know, in the jungle amongst mestizos or, Indians in their traditional context, but you know, for everyone encountering these kinds of things. But it also points to a very profound rift in our Western way of thinking about the world, which is this subject-object split. I'm a subject. I have things that happen in my brain, which is inside of my skull, and produces this mind experience. And there's an objective world out there that science can measure, and that certainly does not contain, visionary queens of other realms who, you know, enter into my field of vision with a train of glowing UFOs. I mean, that's just not something that exists in that objective world. But there's something very unsatisfying about this divide, and I'm hoping that Chip can help us explore this vision, because he offers a very interesting way to think about these things in his paper and in his work. But before we get to him, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daoud. Hi, Maja. Maja, are you there? I do not hear a Maja. Well, then I guess we should proceed on and bring on Chip Horner here on Expanding Mind. Chip, you there?
Eric, I am. How the hell are you?
Good, good.
Good.
Good to see you. Well, hopefully we'll have our co-host swimming in here eventually. I'm kind of torn here. On the one hand, we haven't really talked very much. I'm kind of curious about your story and how you came to, think and talk about these matters. That's usually a place I like to start off. But I'm also just sort of itching to get into this topic because it's really such a fascinating one. So I'll just let you kind of set up your interest in these matters, or really what drew you to write about this particular topic of ayahuasca shamanism.
It's been a long trip. I think it all started back when a friend of mine showed up with a bag of shrooms. I got into this through psychedelics. Graduated high school early, really hating the whole process of like institutional learning. Got out on my own, was kind of messing around, getting in trouble, and came across psychedelics just out of the blue. So a friend had given me about 10 grams of psilocybin mushrooms, and without knowing much about psychedelics or how to set up a proper or more responsible experience, I just went ahead and did them on my own. In a small studio apartment with a lot of music and lights and bullshit in the background. And what happened was that I started off by taking half the bag, and things were going great after about an hour. And so I decided to take the rest of it. And that's when things got a little bit interesting. So needless to say, after that, I really had an experience that really blew everything open. Everything had a question mark next to it after I came down, because I had sort of had these really bizarre experiences that I couldn't account for with my own cultural background. Didn't grow up with religion or any sort of organized way of thinking about these things, so it was more a matter of me venturing out, trying to piece it together after the shards were sort of blown apart.
So well, wonderful. I want to ask you a little more about that, but I guess we have Maja back on the line. Maja, how are you doing?
Hi, Eric. The entity has kicked me off.
There we go. Well, we're just going to keep on moving here. So, Chip, I mean, I love that you start off with that direct experience. I think it's often the case that people's questions that they pursue with their work have their origins in these often very intense experiences that come about through all sorts of means, and I can hear from you and even read in your ideas certain frustration with the typical way that we learn in this society, how we construct the world with our different knowledge forms. But so at the same time, it's kind of familiar, but most people who have those kinds of experiences where they're shattered and they're blown up and they're looking for other kinds of explanations, other kinds of practices that can help them move through these suddenly very real questions, don't end up going into a kind of highbrow academic environment where you're wrestling with all sorts of very materialist ideas, very secular ideas, lots of people who hate anything that smells like the New Age or religion or anything like that, and really immersing yourself in some of those languages and in the philosophical jargon or et cetera, in order to explore and articulate the kinds of other solutions or other ways of thinking about things that are raised by this very non-academic kind of experience. So how did that come about?
Well, really, I started with that experience because that's what propelled me into actually, taking responsibility for my own learning. That in high school I'd really skated through. I was a C student. I had no idea that I'd ever even go to college. I never wanted to go to college. But when this happened, it was right before I was about to start a community college program, actually to become a firefighter, something totally different. And so after that, it really forced me to try to answer those questions for myself. And where I was looking, this is also kind of a strange story, is that I was, you know, my own background, I had an interest in rock and roll, in rock music, rock criticism, things like this. And so, you know, I turned to, even before this happened, I was reading a lot, you know, biographies and random things. And, one of my favorite figures I got into was, Jim Morrison. You know, so it's kind of a cliche at this point, but that if you dig through, the Morrison materials, I mean, all throughout that is, seeds for everything, you know, that you can find the Beats, you can find, William Blake, you can find, Rambo, you know, that in trying to track down who these figures were, that's kind of how I was piecing together my own education. So I already had, some handholds, you know, some foothold in this area, but that what I needed to do was sort of, you know, think through it more, process it more. So I used my time at school, to do that. I switched, my concentration. I was thinking I was going to become an English major, and that changed down the road as I got more interested in reading mystical literature. So that's sort of what the sea change was there.
So would you say then, like, these entities and the mushrooms that you took that gave you that experience then really kind of resulted in changing your life or controlling your life or pushing it in another direction, sort of?
It absolutely did. I mean, I'm still on the fence about what to think about this. You know, that's one of the things that I try to maintain all throughout, is that I don't want to say that these are, entities or that these aren't entities, but I wanted to think through that problem. It seemed like a really pressing problem. But what it did was provide, you know, what I think it was Todorov that called, in Kreipeltasis, in his work, Eric, was a meaning event, you know, something that really was an eruption or sort of a rupture that forces you to scramble to try to fill in what happened. And you're always constantly re-narrativizing it, trying to grapple with that, but you never quite reach a satisfactory conclusion. And so it's always been that way for me. And I think it will continue to be, but whatever happened, it definitely changed the course of my life. And you can call that karma, or you can call that entities that are sort of, you know, encouraging you to tell some kind of story or to change history somehow. But for me, it was more of just this radical experience that I didn't know what to do with, and I still don't really know what to do with. And
well, it's such a great point, too. I think that we often forget that when we're thinking about certainly other people's lives, but even our own, that, you know, we may talk to somebody and they have an idea about how realities run, that there are UFOs, for example, and they're like, no, there's UFOs, people see these things, they're real, da-da-da-da, and oftentimes, you know, our tendency is to get into a thing about what they believe. It's like, is this true? Is it not true? Why do they believe that? What's the thing? But if you probe people's lives, you often, I think even generally, find that strong ideas, strong convictions, particularly ones that are outside of the norm, have within them some experience, some gap. But the experience is not the same thing as the belief. It's not like I have
right.
some experience that gives me incontrovertible proof that there are UFOs. That story that my experience proves that there are UFOs is something I kind of develop a little bit afterwards, sometimes
yes.
a lot afterwards. Sometimes
I totally agree with what you're saying. I think that this is a very key point that I struggle with within my own life, and that I also have a Buddhist practice, you know. And then how do all these things fit in with a Buddhist cosmology, with a Tibetan Buddhist Nyingmapa cosmology? And I finally decided that these are different phenomena that are occurring from different bodily practices, different ways of understanding, and more importantly, different ways of shutting down sources of knowledge or opportunities to transform that. I think that belief kind of comes in to fill the gap after experience to dissipate that feeling of unknowing, you know.
Absolutely. And in a way, that's a lot of what I think spiritual but not religious practice is a constant cultivation and reconnection with a kind of unknowing that doesn't prevent you from trying to understand, trying to map, trying to create stories, but, you know, encourages you to hold them lightly because it's a very difficult thing to do. It can be lonely, it can be confusing, it can be even despairing sometimes because there's this sense, this desire for some kind of coherent story. But there's another side of it, which is this sort of constant, it becomes a practice itself. And because the temptation, of course, is to, once you've had some kind of opening or an anomalous experience or a profound meditative experience, is there's a temptation to kind of fill it in with a new set of beliefs. And you see this everywhere. You see this in parapsychology and Buddhism and psychedelics, and it's understandable and maybe even good at some points to go through a period where we really are holding on to certain kinds of convictions. But we're talking about something, something a little bit different here. And in particular, you know, to turn more specifically to this topic of the kinds of beings that people experience in visionary realms, and particularly in visionary psychedelic realms, there's a tendency for people sometimes to have some overwhelming experience that's so contrary to a conventional way of thinking about material reality that you go to the other side and you say, yes, there are these beings and they're outside us and they have, you know, gifts for us and they have messages for us and they're telling us things and they're calling us to realign our lives, to reform our understanding of the world, often with this kind of naive conviction in many ways. And I say naive not like it's silly, but just that it's not really thought through, not really engaged. And what you're trying to do, you know, and you use the tools of philosophy and theory to do it, but you're really wrestling with something much more concrete and basic in our bodies and in our experience, which is how to open up and understand and think about these beings, entities, if we will, or these experiences, without either assuming that they're just projections of the mind or figures that come out of our own cultural expectations, and at the same time without believing that they're transcendental entities that have their own kinds of being that's sort of like us, except they're invisible. How to figure out a place in between, how to keep that ambiguity open. So what were the ways that you came to understand or to work your way into this very interesting, challenging place between belief and, you know, materialist reduction or dismissal of these experiences?
I'm sorry, you were breaking up a little bit there, but you're asking me how can we make inroads into understanding this?
Yeah. I mean, what were some of the ways you tried to approach this problem of thinking about the nature of the entities?
Yeah. Well, I had to get creative with it. I had to piece together a lot of bits and pieces of theory, but it's what I found when I was chasing down the story is that there's a push in the academy, at least, to start to bring in, I don't know if you can even call it the same thing, but that the concern with affect is something that is gaining a lot of tread in the academy. And for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with that as a critical term, it's a very overloaded term, but that in general, I think you could say that it's affect is an experience where it's a qualitative perception rather than sensory data that's informing or alarming or lighting up your experience.
And you can start with just sort of the basic idea of feeling, you know, that we have feelings. You walk into a place, you have a certain feeling about it. That's not necessarily the same thing as telling that it's cold or it's clammy or it's dark, those sort of sensory experiences. So there's sort of an ambient sense of feeling, which might be our own emotions. That's one way of starting to understand this idea, or even a kind of intuitive sense. Something's off, something's very warm, something's energetic, it's lively. And in a way, that's a more kind of personal way of talking about affect. But I think that's also a way to sort of move into that sense of understanding how feelings are not just sensory. There's something else going on there that this concept tries to get to.
Yeah, so let's try to tease this out a little bit more. So the way that I'm using affect and the way that a lot of these theorists are, you know, Masumi with being the primary figurehead, that there's a pre-linguistic space between a stimulus and a reaction and between the reaction and the consciousness of it. So digging deeper, we're talking about a kind of non-reflective bodily space or atmosphere, you know, like the example you used, before you actually process that from the perspective of a subject in control of their experience. The affects are, flipping back into the neuroscientific and Chavez and piece that I was working on with the piercing abduction stuff, is that from the neuroscientific perspective, what I dug out was that there's reference to these as subcortical affect appraisals, and that the, you know, without going into the brain science of it, obviously because I don't have a very strong background, but just have read the secondary literature, that with these, it's something that happens faster than you can organize the experience into cultural forms or idioms, sort of recognizable patterns. It's something that somehow manages to elude that, but not because it's a freak experience, but rather because it proceeds directly from the body and between bodies without interference or limitations of consciousness, representational.
Sure.
Representation of, basically, they're pre-personal is the way I've talked about them before.
Yeah.
It's something that happens before you can organize it.
Yeah, in a way you can, again, think about, you know, in more colloquial terms, just what we mean when we say feeling. And sometimes there's feelings kind of going on in the background of what we're doing, and we're not even really sure, and there's some kind of odd, and then suddenly something will direct you, like, wait, how do you feel here, or what's the feeling of this room? You walk into a room, and something kind of odd, but you're doing something, you're not really paying attention, and then you kind of reflect on it, and you realize that there's sort of, you don't know what you feel. You don't have a word for it. And then you go, if someone says, hey, well, how are you feeling now? You go, well, I feel kind of weird. I'm a little unnerved. And then you start to use words to organize these feelings. And then as soon as you do that, you have a story. Well, I have fear because I feel weird in this room. So I'm afraid. I got to do something about this.
And I think a better word to describe those, which a lot of people forget about, and which miraculously to me, no one really thinks about, is the word instinct. And a lot of scientists use that word. They say, oh, how did the animal know to do that? And they go, oh, it's instinct. It's instinct. Well, what the heck is instinct? It means, like, if you look at Kant, you know something without ever having experienced it. It's a priori knowledge that comes, like you said, before there's any time to organize data, before there's, you know, you get it in through your eyeballs or your nose or your mouth and your brain processes it and it tells you that's that. Instinct is something that is a priori to that, that it arises from somewhere within your body, within the flesh, usually animals, but us too, and then it expresses and you have knowledge of something in a feeling, right? And then it comes out and is expressed.
I like that reading of it, and I think I use that a lot, but that at the same time, what I like about affect, too, is that there's also this kind of stress on a quality that is really dispossessive, you know, that's shocking or surprising or astonishing or elusive, you know, something that throws you, that puts you beside yourself. And, you know, we can go forward with that, but that affect in general is a very slippery term for better and for worse, and I like to emphasize all those qualities while still, you know, not over-determining it as instinct alone or as surprise alone or, you know, whatever. I think that I'm trying to reach for something like Eric was doing where it's, in the example of walking into a room, you know, there's some there's a perhaps instinct, but also there's maybe some kind of surprising aspect of that room that you don't really know what to do with yet. You know, maybe I've been here before, or maybe this reminds me of something that I can't put my finger on. And there's this kind of reeling that occurs upon that experience, where in many ways, and for figures like Peirce, this is really the source of scientific knowledge, is a source of theories, of hypothesizing, of trying to disarm that kind of feeling of being at ease, that feeling of being ill at ease, into something that is recognizable. So it's something that kind of precedes or eludes the recognizable as well. And I like that quality of the example that Eric was using.
Well, and do you think that that is something that comes from within the person, or with, like, talking about entities and kind of what exactly they
right.
are? I mean, would you say that's something that is extremely internal, or is a combination of internal and external?
Well, that's what really fascinated me about all this, is that where is this, you know, how can we even say internal or external in the first place? Internal
right.
or external, according to what? You know, according to what perspective? And as that perspective changes, which is largely overcoded by culture, then our ideas of what's internal and external also change. I think that there's what we're reaching for, trying to grasp for, struggle with a lot of our you know, dalliances and transformative practices or spirituality more broadly, are generally new ways of conceiving ourselves and our world, and practices that allow us to enter into that more fully. So
yeah.
I can't even say internal or external. I think that that's kind of a question that has been front-loaded into our own religious and intellectual history, and that's kind of what I was doing with in a portion of my paper, is to trying to get outside of those distinctions that are really tied to this kind of Cartesian dualistic perceptual ontology.
Right.
Yeah,
so
I mean, one way of thinking about it is that the difference between subject and object, it's so, for us, instinctual. You know, it's just clear. It's like, you know, if you ask us in the middle of some understanding of ourselves, hey, where do you feel like? Well, I'm in here. I'm thinking about things. There's this world out here, outside, that I'm mapping and trying to organize. And it's so basic to us, but when you look at it, you realize that there are different ways of drawing that line. And even, you know, we become fascinated by what they call non-dual traditions, where they say there's ultimately no difference between subject and object, between the inside world and the external world. And that's like, wow, that sounds amazing, but man, is that far away from my experience most of the time. So before we even get, you know, to talking about non-dualism and all the problems and marvels that idea raises, we can, I think, understand more easily, more accessibly, that the ways in which we draw the lines between inside and outside change in different circumstances, and they change in different kinds of cultures. It's not
right.
like the sort of half-mythical image we have of Indians in the jungle don't have subject and object. It's not like they're not in a world where they're doing things in a world out there. But the way that line is drawn is very, very different. And I think you're totally right that whether or not we're even aware of it, that a lot of the motivation between transformative practices, meditation, yoga, different kinds of martial arts, different kinds of trance cultivation, even travel, even reading, there's a desire to play with that boundary so that things that seemed inside now appear from the outside and vice versa, as that line itself becomes much more waxy, you know, much more furtive, where it's hard to exactly pin down. And I think that that's partly what is so attractive and fascinating about the shamanic situation, is that it so radically redraws and in some ways erases that line in a way that you know it's hard to just put it back in the box and say, oh well, that's just stuff that's happening inside of their heads.
And it seems that that's what's driving a lot of these practices, is an active cultivation of that, an active cultivation of trying to know things differently. So I don't know where we want to go in the interview at this point, but maybe.
Well, we're on the half an hour, so we got to take a break. So we'll come back in a couple of minutes. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Dawu. We're talking to Chip Horner about the University of the Forest, ayahuasca shamanism, and its challenges to our Western way of thinking. So we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Dawu. We're here with Eric Davis, talking with Chip Horner about all kinds of fun things that can happen with experiences of consciousness in relation to forests, entities, entheogens, all that good stuff. And before the break, we were trying to get into a little bit about that unification of the idea of the inside and the outside. And so I'm curious, because for me, one of the things that's most interesting to me, okay, you can have an experience, you know, you take ayahuasca and an entity will come and talk to you. It'll be like a spirit, you know, let's say a dragon spirit comes and talks to you. Okay, and then you think, oh, I got visited by this transcendental being, but then you kind of think about it and you're like, well, you kind of said a lot of things that are in my own mind and maybe that dragon is kind of in me. So then you take it from transcendental and you kind of put it inside yourself. But then you break out again and you say, well, oh, look at this book talks about all this stuff that dragons say to people, and it was all the same stuff that this dragon said to me. So then you get like this kind of toss-up where you're like, well, okay, it is inside and outside, but then it's also like this particular dragon spirit has been recognized as this kind of identity, right? And then you get kind of like the archetype, right? So, okay, if this is like not really just from in me, but also outside of me, but oh, wait, this spirit has like an identity that exists throughout eons where people say like it kind of has the same name, it does the same thing, it's like this thing that we can interact with. So for you, I mean, how would you explain that concept of that breaking through that, yes, there is, it's not inside or outside, but that there are these spirits that have an identity and they're kind of like a thing in the world?
Yeah. Well, I don't have a whole lot of familiarity with dragon spirits, but I'll see if I can do my best here. Okay, so we have this struggle between whether entities are actual or imaginary, right?
Right.
Is this a product, like Eric had mentioned in the intro, is this just a projection or something I'm experiencing in my head that's not actually out there in agreeable, actual, real, you know, measurable metric space, you know? Is this something that I'm experiencing or distorting, or is it something that is a consensus reality? And that already brings in that distinction between internal, external, and subject and object. You know, is this me or is this something that's an object that's real that I can measure?
Right.
So in even answering this question, that's what I was up against, and I'm constantly up against, because outside of shamanism, you also have you have stories all over in comparative religion, especially in the tantric traditions, about entities that you interact with, perhaps receive boons from, or cities, you know, paranormal powers, whatever. But at the same time, those are sort of overwritten by a kind of non-dual philosophical approach that emerged within those traditions to try to tame or domesticate a lot of those practices and ideas. So even in those traditions themselves, it's at odds. It's sort of like it's both and both neither. So we have something that is based off an idea that immaterial means unreal. And first of all, we have to strike that from the record, that immaterial does not mean unreal. And what I was trying to do here is I brought in Deleuze, who's sort of a slick theorist that has been popular in the academy for the past couple decades, three decades, in the West, in the United States at least. And in talking about, and talking about Bergson and talking about a lot of other philosophical matters, Proust appropriated an adage, Deleuze appropriated an adage from Proust in talking about Proust's idea of involuntary memory. And this is real without being actual, mm-hmm. ideal without being abstract. So entities are real. I like this coinage because it works for what I'm doing too. The entities are real, at least in an Amerindian or a mestizo context, because they provide pragmatic information and it could produce very real effects through the healer's curative abilities. They're actually able to cure. And it, like across the board, if you look at this literature, that Vegetalistas and Ayahuasqueros constantly attribute their power and efficacy in healing to the spirits and not to themselves.
Right.
Okay, so they're real, and they produce real effects in the curative. They're real because they provide pragmatic information and produce real effects in their curative abilities. Okay, but however, they're also, this is from Stephen Beyer in his book, Singing to the Plants, that they're also akin to imaginary objects, and that they lack, you know, sensory coherence. They'll take on different forms. They don't sort of obey the rules of human persons that we're used to. So we're in kind of a strange shadow area, and that's what I was trying to unpack with my thesis, that you have real, autonomous, consistent personalities, you know, self-awareness, volition, speech, memory, and can provide information and insight, but that they're imaginary at the same time. For those reasons, lack sensory coherence, they're not public, they're unusual or inconsistent in their behavior, appearance differs, all on and on. But even that distinction is shaky. You can pull up different scenarios. Let's say the example of like a Vegetalista being able to modulate the visions of people in a healing ceremony. How can you have someone do that under those same auspices that just accorded real versus imaginary? So we're in an unusual place, and with Deleuze, you have a different conception of the body, okay? So this is what I'm leaning on here, is that the body is not the individual organism. For Deleuze, this would be like the molar form or molar form or function of a particular entity, but a molecular composition of relations and differential capacities to affect and be affected while undergoing transition. So with Deleuze, you have a different idea of the body and of identity more broadly, that the body is an assemblage of affects that, you know, that we've been talking about. That you're not a unified being, but a super divided being.
Well, and that would have to be true if you believed that the spirits are not inside or outside you, right? Because that's
right.
Like the connecting point. Then if it's something that is immaterial that physically affects your own body, but yet is not directly inside you or not directly outside you, then you're actually made up of it, right? It's making
right.
you.
Well, that accords so well with the sort of way that in the shamanic world view that the world itself is a festival of personalities, of entities, of other kinds of people, even if they're not. We're human people, but then there are bear people, and there are jaguar people, and there are frog people, that there's this kind of sense of personification that, you know, we think of in terms of the word animism, which is a really, you know, a very interesting idea, but also one that you have to really look at what you mean by it. But I was really struck by one thing rereading your paper where you quote a Brazilian anthropologist and talking about how that the sort of Western frame of mind, the assumption is that what we're really trying to do when we know the world, when we understand the world, is to be able to reduce things to objects that we can describe and we can coherently understand. So it's like, well, people, this guy had a hallucination of a dragon. Well, what's really going on is that, you know, his amygdala was misfiring and et cetera, et cetera. So that now we have this object, the amygdala, out there that we can measure, and then that's how knowledge is produced. And this is deeply ingrained in us, even if we're not scientists. Even if we're not scientists, deeply ingrained is this idea that we ultimately kind of live in a world of objects, and if you can describe those objects, then you're capturing reality. But this, the Amerindian approach to knowledge, where for example, for a vegetaliso, it's like, well, if I can hook up with the right spirit, I might actually be able to find out why this person is ill. I might be able to find out what's happening to the village. I might be able to find out where a lost object is. I.e., that, like, what I want to do is to find other beings out there, other ways of organizing, and that inevitably makes this world of things that have a little bit of personhood to them, even if they're not, even if they're very much not human persons. And in a way, it feels like, how do we take that way of experiencing the world and make and sort of bring it into a more Western context, where we're not just, you know, saying, oh, those amazing Indians in the jungle, they have such a magical way of experiencing the world. Instead going, huh, that's actually a productive and interesting way of understanding the world. What would it mean for us to start to understand, and especially ourselves, that way? I mean, what I want to ask you more about is this way of understanding our own bodies, our own selves, if you will, not as a singular thing, but rather as a kind of collection, or what's the word, assemblage of different kinds of beings and relationships, relations to my DNA, relations to the space I'm in, relations to other bodies in the environment. How does that idea become real for you? I mean, how do you actually explore that possibility in your own life?
Right. So you had mentioned Viveros de Castro, and this is really the primary influence on my paper in reconfiguring how I thought about this. So I encourage all your readers to go out and find his work, or to track down those sources from my work itself. But what he brought about is this idea of Amerindian perspectivism, where, it, just as you mentioned, that in this particular situation, this, you know, cultural framework, to know is to objectify, or excuse me, that in our own Western framework, to know is to objectify, and what cannot be objectified simply remains unreal and abstract. You know, things like spirits are a primary example of that. But in Amerindian shamanism, it's the inverse principle at work here, where to know is to personify, and taking the point of view of that which you're trying to know. So it's not a de-subjectification or this kind of abstraction into an idealized form of objectivity, but it's an approach to objects where you try to or already have resubjectified or personified them in order to know them. So
you feel them, right? That's the concept of sympathy. They work by sympathy. It's correspondence, and correspond comes from coer, which is heart response. So it's, instead of, you know, like you were saying, it's, and Eric was saying, they feel them. Instead of trying to, like, say, this is this and that's that, they actually make themselves like the thing. They sympathize, right? Like when a shaman's trying to make rain, what does he do? He pretends he's rain, and that's what brings the rain. So they come into a sympathy with the thing, and that's how they know it, because they be it and they are it.
Sympathy is good, but better than sympathy, I like Viveros de Castro's term, which is cosmic diplomacy. And where he's coming from with that is that this process requires an exchange of perspectives in order to discern the world of which you're trying to know.
Right.
So you're trying to come upon a point of view by engaging objects as subjects, you know, as points of view held together by dominant affects that constitute some kind of, you know, habitual form or mode of being. But in order to even do this, you know, to enter into that sort of perspective switching, it requires an abducing of agency, you know, that you're emptying yourself out. It's a form of kenosis in order to invite in this alien perspective. To know the occult life of objects or things, of animals, of living beings, of meteorological events, what have you, that it requires this capacity to be affected, you know, and affectivity, but it also requires this ability to abide that multiplicity that will enter into your experience. That if you are able to actually do that effectively, and not everyone is, you know, this is a key point too, is that this is the mark of a master shaman, or this is the power of a shaman, is to do this. to be able to maintain multiple perspectives without having one subsume the other. So, for example, in an ayahuasca experience, a very common experience will be to have some sort of alien intelligence enter into that space and either instruct you or challenge you or throw you somehow, but there's something about it that always feels more real than real. And you can write that off as a part of the experience itself and some sort of like drug-induced hallucination. But oftentimes the knowledge that occurs from that, or that occurs from having that perspective enter in alongside or with or sort of temporarily subsuming your own, is oftentimes things that you have no knowledge of yourself or you shouldn't be able to know. And that's something to me that's very distinctive about the ayahuasca experience, that less so in other psychedelic experiences, although that can happen as well and has happened to me as well. And I like Doyle's coinage here of ecodelics, you know, that Maja, you had mentioned entheogen, and I think entheogen plays into that same assumption that, you know, there's some sort of non-dual intelligence that, or power that we actually are, and that anything else is sort of a you know, distortions of that, but that somehow that underlies our experience and that we can tap into that. And that's being manifested in these experiences, that these are all effects of our psyche, of psychedelic. But there's something different that I like about what Doyle's doing, and that he stresses what's being manifested is this meshed interconnection, you know, this sort of the background connectivity that precedes our own production of an ego, our own production of our sense of individuality that allows us to navigate the world, but is also kind of a lie in many ways, and overshadows our relations with others, and overshadows the singularities of experience that we come across. We sort of tend to overlook just how valuable others are in going about our business as a self. So this is kind of getting back to Eric's question, that how does this actually become something we can work with or use, or, you know, it's not just an object of curiosity, or something strange or unfamiliar. And I think it's that you have to, if you want to really engage this, you can at any moment. You know, that think about plants. The plants are a primary example that oftentimes will pass by and not even notice them at all. You know, they're just part of a generalized landscape, that their particularity is overlooked almost incessantly because of the speed of being human, of going about our day and interacting with technology and others. So what if we were to stop, and, you know, this doesn't have to be an airy-fairy kind of spiritual thing. This could be a very practical thing. What if you actually regarded plants as living beings? I mean, a lot of people still don't. A lot of people think they're sort of like intelligent objects, but they're not actually living intelligent beings. And people like Stefano Mancuso, whose TED Talk you can find online, is really calling all this into question with the notion of plants having neurobiology, you know, of studying plant neurobiology through things like signaling and whatnot. So,
you've just said a lot of really great stuff there, and I want to like stay with some of it to try to wrap things up, because we only have about, you know, eight more minutes. One is this idea of ecology. It's an idea that we all kind of, we've come to understand it's a much more important way of thinking about the world than it used to be 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago by far, especially long, you know, in mid-century. And one way of thinking about it is that ecology is the way of describing how lots of different entities interact. And it's holistic on one level because it's about how they all interact. But in other ways, it's very differentiated because it really has to account for many different points of view: the water, the fish, the you know, the pollutant, the weather, the heat, the sun, et cetera, et cetera. And you can start drawing these networks that ultimately kind of extend everywhere, deep into the cosmos, into my own neurology, into my DNA, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a world of multiple perspectives. And I think what Doyle is saying by offering this idea that psychedelics are better called ecodelics is that what they do is allow us to tap in, experience, tell a story, have the perception of this ecodelic field where there are necessarily multiple perspectives that we can understand in terms of ecology, but also understand in terms of these spiritual ecologies of spirits. And I think that one thing that we're pointing to in terms of this inner, outer, science, mysticism divide is that that world of multiple perspectives is a real world, but it's not the way that we normally perceive things because of the way that we have these egos and selves that are trying to control reality. What's marvelous about the psychedelics and about the shamanic sort of perspective in general, and you find it in other non-entheogen gobbling traditions as well, is that spirituality or spiritual experience becomes, as it were, an interface to that extended world that you can think of in very scientific ways or very realistic ways, not in woo-woo ways. But in order to get there, in order to really experience or have in your body a sense of how deeply right now, where you're standing, where you're listening, you are absolutely embedded in all of these unseen, powerful, pulsating networks of affects, of flows, of energy. The right now that's happening. But how do you get there? How do you see that? And spirituality, drugs, entheogens, modes of transforming the body are ways of tuning that field. So what appears like a spirit is not in my head, but it's also not like it's sitting in some astral realm where it like rules that land. It's something that emerges as an interface between my little individual self and that network.
I think that, you know, in terms of how to cultivate this, you know, there's nothing fantastical about it. You know, that in the traditional context, of course, you know, this is a process of long-term learning and of extended opening and exposure, you know, that is of exposing oneself. You know, so without drifting off topic there, I think that in our everyday experience for listeners out there and us included, that what's most important about this for me is that we have an alternative model that doesn't dismiss spirits as unreal and doesn't posit them as real in a way where we need to suddenly scramble to replace or dethrone science and the social authorities that it maintains. But rather, how can we regard things around us differently by becoming more sensitive to them, of articulating our experience in different forms through entering into an engagement with others where we're open to knowing things differently, of having surprise take place, and of actively not putting up the barriers to that, of trying to open ourselves more and more to each other in a way that lets fear in order to transform it into knowledge. You know, I think that's really what I'm interested in with this whole process.
No, that's beautifully said. I mean, another way of thinking about it is a lot of the, it's another way of thinking about a lot of the calls you hear in various spiritual practices and Christian prayer and lots of things to sort of, you know, give up on yourself a little bit, to hold back, to sort of retreat or let that self dissolve. And, you know, you can understand that in terms of compassion so that you can understand other people, so that you're paying more attention. But you can also see it, from another perspective, those same practices of dissolving the self or putting the self on hold or remaining passive in the midst of experiences or fears where you would normally want to control things, and learning to cultivate that as you do in meditation and in all sorts of practices. Part of it is to get that self out of the way so that the world of others, of the rich, full world of others, not just human others or even animal others, but the others in the cosmos, of the world of objects, can kind of appear and have their own say in a way. And so it's like almost creating that parliament of objects inside your own experience. You're not the king, you know. Shut up, get off the throne for once and let everything sort of have its say. And it doesn't necessarily solve the problem because there's a lot of different perspectives. But I think that's part of what spiritual practices are about, and it sounds like that's very much your experience as well.
Yeah, I mean, I like this an ongoing idea that we sort of talked about thus far in this hour. There's a way to sort of, you know, take a shorthand for it that I like from Richard Strader, who is, I don't know what he calls himself, like post-Nietzschean anthropologist or some crazy academic term like that, but he had a term called epistemic brinkmanship. And I really like that because there's an ethics behind this. You know, there's an ethics of the impossible. There's an ethics of aliens, of ghosts, of paranormal abilities. To me, I don't really want to say what it is. I want to allow it to open up new possibilities for our own understanding and reflection and behavior.
Okay, and we're going to have to stop there on that not knowing and not saying. We've been talking to Chip Horner. You can find his his text on NEIPinfo, NEIP.info, under Textos. You'll be able to do a search and find his article. Chips, thanks so much for being on Expanding Mind.
Yeah, thanks, Eric.
It was really great. From me and Maj and all you out there, keep your minds open.